That's Andy Dalton, Bengals quarterback. He's committed through 2020. The Bengals are committed as a practical matter through 2015, 2 years, $25 million. After that, it becomes year to year. But you know what? That's something that we have seen time and again with more and more of these quarterback contracts and contracts generally. Few are guaranteed beyond, as a practical matter, 2 years. Used to be 3 years when the signing bonuses were bigger. Dalton got $12 million to sign, $5 million more in the next 3 days, $17 million in all to get started. Not a bad haul for a guy who was a second-round pick. But what I want to do now is focus on the future, because we expected Colin Kaepernick to get a deal. We expected Cam Newton to get a deal. Not Cam Newton. I'm getting ahead of myself. We expected Andy Dalton to get a deal because both of those guys were entering the final years of their contracts. Let's look at some of the other quarterbacks out there. And I mentioned Cam Newton a little prematurely. There's been nothing premature about Cam Newton's contract talks. And to his credit, he has not grandstanded. He has not insisted on a new deal. He has not threatened to hold out. I was filling in for Dan Patrick back during the Olympics, and Newton said, "I will be there for everything in the offseason." And ultimately, he was there, but he wasn't available to do much because of his ankle. But Newton is now on deck. And here's where Newton is different from Kaepernick and Dalton. And here's where Newton can maybe break the mold of this new Kaepernick structure that really does create team-friendly franchise quarterback contracts. Newton's under contract for two more years. He's due to make a salary of roughly $4 or $5 million this year, and then it kicks up to $14.66 million in 2015. That's the fifth-year option. That's the transition tag this year for quarterbacks. That's what Newton makes next year under the new CBA, $14.66. We throw in a year of the franchise tag at $17.59 million in 2016. We're looking at about $35 million minimum for Cam Newton over the next 3 years. So he's got a much better starting point than Dalton or Kaepernick. They were due to make $1 million in the final year of their contract. Newton is looking at least $35 million over the next 3 years. So if and when the Panthers are ready to talk, you're talking about a much higher starting point for Cam Newton and a much better contract in the end. Now the question is, can he still get something that doesn't track the Kaepernick and Dalton structure, or does he need to push this thing to a franchise tag, to a second franchise tag? Does he really need to go year to year for more than a year or two to get something better than the Dalton and Kaepernick deal? That's going to be something to keep an eye on. And then you've got the 2012 quarterback class. None of them are eligible for new contracts now. But every quarterback drafted, along with every other player drafted in 2012, will be eligible for a new contract after the season. And let's start with the first overall pick in 2012, Andrew Luck. Everybody assumes he's going to get a big deal, huge deal, gigantic deal, and he deserves it. Keep this in mind. Twice the Colts forced Peyton Manning to finish out a contract and then waited until he was under the franchise tag before signing him to a new deal. If the Colts apply that same precedent that was applied to Peyton Manning to Andrew Luck, Andrew Luck's not getting a new contract until February, March of 2017, when he is in his franchise year, his fifth year in the NFL. So it's going to be a while. Have I gotten my years right? 2014 is year three. 2015 is year four. And they'd make him play out his fifth-year option. It would be 20. My gosh, it's going to be a long time until Andrew Luck gets paid if the Colts do to him what they did to Peyton Manning. Now, with Russell Wilson, Seahawks quarterback, I fully expect he'll get a new contract after this year. And he could break that mold that NFL teams are trying to create with Colin Kaepernick and Andy Dalton's deal, because, first of all, the Seahawks have been very fair with their core players like Earl Thomas and Richard Sherman. And secondly, this is a great opportunity for the Seahawks to tweak the 49ers by pointing out, either directly or indirectly, that they don't take advantage of their franchise quarterback, that they pay guys fairly. They don't force them to sign these ridiculous long-term deals that are year to year. They don't force guys to go out and pay $2 million pre-tax for insurance policies that pay the team if there's a catastrophic injury. They're just not going to do that. RG3 is a wild card in this, because if he plays this year like he played in 2012, then he's going to be in line to get paid. And back when Luck and Griffin were bubbling up for the draft, I was told that Griffin really didn't want to be taken by the Colts, because Griffin's representatives understand that the Colts will wait until the last possible minute to do a deal. Daniel Snyder in Washington, he loves him some RG3. RG3 is going to end up getting that big contract possibly after this season, but he needs to play like he did in 2012 to justify the kind of money that he's going to be looking for. Nick Foles, wild card in Philly. Will he play like he did last year? What will the Eagles do after the 2014 season? But he'll be eligible. And then there's Ryan Tannehill. I mean, if he has a bad year this year, Dolphins may just decide not to pick up the fifth-year option. That happened with the 8th, 10th, and 12th overall picks from 2011. Tannehill, the 8th overall pick from 2012. He could be entering a contract year in 2015 because the Dolphins may decide after this year they don't want to commit that top 10, that transition tag number, that $15 million plus is what it'll likely be by 2016 when Tannehill's in year 5. So it could be that this is a make-or-break year for Tannehill in more ways than one. Now, let's talk about veterans who are out there who are hoping to get new contracts. And we've talked about Ben Roethlisberger and his situation in Pittsburgh. He believes he's already giving the team a hometown discount. He's due to make $12.1 million this year, $11.6 million next year. Contract talks tabled until after the current season. What are the Steelers going to do? And are they going to try to do a Kaepernick-Dalton structure? Are they going to pay Ben Roethlisberger big money, a $30 million signing bonus like the one Tom Brady got a couple of years ago when he supposedly took less money? We all should take so much less money that we get $30 million to sign. And a couple of other big-name guys also with 2 years left on their contracts. Eli Manning, and he is due to make $15.1 million this year, $17 million 2015. The way he's played the last couple of years, if he doesn't turn it around, what are the Giants going to do? Are they going to pay him $20 million a year? Are they going to pay him $18 million a year? Are they just going to let him hit the market, let the market decide what he's worth? And is anybody going to want to pay Eli Manning big money? Because Eli Manning has not played well since that last Super Bowl win. Phillip Rivers having a career resurgence, although I don't know what he's really coming back from. He was the comeback player of the year last year. I still can't figure out what he came back from. He's got 2 years left under his current contract at 13.8 and 15.75. Look for him to get paid. And then a couple of guys at the bottom of the barrel that I just want to mention as we wrap this up. Alex Smith in Kansas City. You know the Chiefs are trying to get Alex Smith to do the Colin Kaepernick contract because Kaepernick's the guy that bumped Alex Smith out of San Francisco. And if Smith were willing to do the Kaepernick structure, he'd already have a deal. This one could go all the way through the season and to the franchise tag. And then the real question for the Chiefs is going to be, because when you consider Andy Reid's history of developing quarterbacks, do they pay Alex Smith $17 million or so under the franchise tag? Or do they make Aaron Murray the quarterback at $510,000 for 2015? That's a difference of about 34 times greater to keep Smith under the tag than to just go with Aaron Murray. We rarely see franchise quarterbacks hit the open market, and I don't know whether or not Alex Smith is a franchise quarterback, but he may be hitting the open market. And keep in mind, he's got a lot of football left. He just turned 30 earlier this year. Feels like this guy's been around forever. He just turned 30 earlier this year. He's got a lot of football left. Jake Locker was a guy the Titans decided not to pick up the fifth-year option on, but he's their starting quarterback. What if he has a big year? I mean, it's not impossible. If he has a big year, Titans' hands are going to be tied. What do they do with him come 2015? And then lastly, Brian Hoyer. The Browns want to extend him. His agent wants to wait and see what happens. If Hoyer ends up being the starter, and I still don't think that's the case, if he's the starter and he has a big year, well, the Browns aren't going to pay him a ton of money. They got Johnny Football. Hoyer could be a guy who ends up attracting some dollars. And why do we spend the entire first segment of the show on quarterback contracts? Because there aren't enough good quarterbacks to go around in the NFL. And there's this presumption that good quarterbacks are always going to stay with the team they currently play for. I think we look at the names we just discussed. Some of those guys aren't going to be with their teams over the long haul. It's impossible that all of those guys, given their circumstances, are going to continue to be with their teams over the long haul. And the reality is, any of those guys hit the open market, yeah, there will be someone else who pays them because there's always a team looking for a good quarterback. Whether all those guys are good quarterbacks, that's a subject for debate. The Bills are looking for a new owner, and we're going to catch up with Tim Graham of the Buffalo News when we come back about how this process is unfolding. He had a fascinating story today about how Bon Jovi and Donald Trump may have already violated the confidentiality agreement that they signed before they bid on the team by talking about, you know, it's the old Fight Club rule. They're not supposed to talk about buying the Bills, and they've been talking about buying the Bills. How big of a problem is that? How big of a chance does Bon Jovi really have? And we may actually talk about, we may not make any promises or guarantees. We actually may talk about the Buffalo Bills football team for 2014 with Tim Graham. And then we're going to talk to you. We've already got a bunch of very good questions queued up in the Twitter stack. We're going to open the phone lines to wrap the show as well. It's been a while since we've done it. Looking forward to hearing from you and answering your questions as the preseason prepares to hit full speed. We're moving as quickly as we can. We're going to move through these commercial breaks. Please stick around. Please pay attention. Please, please buy the products that are being offered to you in the next minute or so. And please stick around for Tim Graham of the Buffalo News. He'll be with us after the break. This is PFT Live. That's NBC's Al Michaels from the Hall of Fame game Sunday night, dropping some news, giving us a nugget, giving us the basis for what quickly became a post, profootballtalk.com. Donald Trump offers $1 billion cash to purchase the Buffalo Bills, and then blabs about it to Al Michaels, which isn't exactly out of character for Donald Trump. Joining us now, not Donald Trump, but Tim Graham of the Buffalo News to help us understand where things stand with the sale of the team and also the fate of the 24 edition of the Buffalo Bills. Tim, let's start with Donald Trump. Are you buying that he offered $1 billion in cash, and do you think he has a serious chance of getting the team?
I'm not buying it, but that doesn't mean it can't be accurate. Nobody really knows what Donald Trump is worth. Nobody really knows what anybody is worth. These Forbes evaluations come out, or estimates every year about the richest Americans and things. Those are just guesses. And I think, you know, people who are worth a lot of money are pretty good at stashing it in places where people aren't supposed to know really what they're worth. But $1 billion cash seems a little bit too liquid for Donald Trump. And but the thing is that there are reports out there that the Terry Pegula group, that the Toronto group, they're prepared to go way higher than that. So it would be silly for Morgan Stanley, the bank handling this, to take up Donald Trump on what is a non-binding bid, by the way. And say, okay, well, gee, Donald, $1 billion cash. Well, let's end this process right now. There's more bidding to be done. Terry Pegula is worth he's worth a couple billion, but he just sold oil lands in West Virginia and Ohio for $1.75 billion a couple months ago. So if Morgan Stanley knows that there's more cash out there to be gotten for the purchase of the team, they're not just going to end the process just because Donald Trump thinks he came up with a good bid.
And it's amazing to think that cash would even be relevant for this kind of a transaction. This isn't buying a used car from the lot at the end of the road, where if you have cash, it somehow has more meaning than going and applying for a loan. Whatever the value is, they're going to get their money when it's all said and done. The financing is going to be the problem of the new buyer going forward. It really is amazing to me. And I ultimately think, and I don't know one way or the other what Donald Trump is worth, but this is a great way to get people thinking that he's worth so much that he could write a check for $1 billion and not, you know, and take that and still have other money to do all his other stuff. He's got $1 billion laying around he can spend on a football team, and he's willing to do it. So I really didn't buy it. The other thing that fascinated me was your story today about how Donald Trump and John Bon Jovi may have already violated the confidentiality agreement that they signed before they submitted their non-binding bids. Please explain what happened here.
Well, I obtained yesterday a copy of the non-disclosure agreement that the Bills sent out to prospective buyers that had to be signed and returned before they could begin the process to find out about the Bills' financials, to take a look at the books, all that type of stuff. And about 60 of these non-disclosure agreements were sent out, but only about 15 were signed. And we can get back into the reasons for that, because this non-disclosure agreement was considered too strict, too restrictive for some potential bidders liking. And they didn't want to sign it because they thought it maybe gave away some of their ability to negotiate. But anyways, regarding the breach of the confidentiality, at the top of the second page of the non-disclosure agreement, it specifically states that you cannot express or you cannot disclose any interest that you can't even tell anybody that you're interested in buying the Buffalo Bills. So Donald Trump all along, whether it be through him or one of his spokesmen, have stated to news organizations on the record in front of cameras in some cases, that he's going to bid on the Buffalo Bills, and not even what Al Michaels had to report during the Hall of Fame game on Sunday night. He told Fox News the day before he was going to submit a bid, that he was going to put the bids going in tomorrow, but I don't think I'm going to get the team, et cetera, et cetera. So that would be a violation. You can't say that you're interested in a team. And then John Bon Jovi had an open letter, which was given exclusively to the Buffalo News. He wanted to try to sway some public opinion. And in it, he explained what his intentions were with the Buffalo Bills if he were to be the winning bidder. So that's a violation of the non-disclosure agreement. There doesn't seem to be any real ramifications for these violations. No clear punishment. It's not that they're eliminated from the process or they could be sued because there's really no financial harm being done to the Bills. They're not disclosing the too much of the confidential information, that type of thing. But still, it could and probably does alienate Morgan Stanley, the trust, the NFL, when they're trying to go through this process as they see fit. And there are groups out there that are kind of thumbing their nose at it. And then there's the Tom Golisano part. He's the former owner of the Buffalo Sabres, who just blew right past last week's deadline. There was a deadline on Tuesday to submit the non-binding initial bid. And he said, I'll just file mine whenever I want to. Which I guess when there are only three bids that come in, of course Morgan Stanley is going to accept somebody else's bid, even if it's late. But still, you have all these different groups out there that are pretty much doing whatever they want to do in this process. And I think that bodes well for the only guy who has done it the right way all along and hasn't made any of these missteps, and that's Terry Pegula, the owner of the Buffalo Sabres and fracking billionaire who's got the cash.
Is there anyone else out there that we know of? As far as I can tell, we know of the three groups that made bids before last Tuesday's deadline, Bon Jovi, Trump, and Pegula. You mentioned Golisano, that he may decide to swoop in at some point and put a bid on the table. Anyone else that we should be keeping an eye on?
Not really. The only other person out there who was sniffing around was Jeffrey Gundlach. He's a Buffalo area native who's now based in Los Angeles, and he is a bond broker and considered one of the most formidable investment guys in the world. And he has the wherewithal to do it and was sniffing around, talking to different people, talking to Jim Kelly about possibly partnering up. Everything's been all quiet with that. Now, can we definitively say that only three bids were made last week? No, we can't, because Morgan Stanley, as Morgan Stanley should, isn't talking about that part of the process. But there's a belief out there among a lot of people who I talk to who are involved in the process, close to the process, however you want to qualify this, that say if there were more than three bids, word would have leaked out somewhere, because it's bad for business to have so few bids. And it's bad for the NFL in a certain sense to think that there are only three bids for such a precious asset. And that if there were multiple bids or more bids that we were missing, we would have found out by now, just for public relations purposes, that there is more interest in the Bills than is being reported.
You mentioned the Bon Jovi letter. Has that moved the needle at all? I mean, this letter comes out at a time when public opinion is decidedly against Bon Jovi. They don't believe that he would keep the team in Buffalo. Did the letter do him any good?
No, it hurt him. It hurt him quite a bit. And I've heard words from people who are involved in this, whether it be from other potential ownership groups or people who, with the league office or at One Bills Drive, words like stupid, ridiculous, never seen anything like it. Yeah, everybody thought that it was dumb, not only because he had so many holes in the argument and he left so many questions unanswered, it forced people to talk about it even more, to revisit it. It was such a, it ran in the Sunday edition of the Buffalo News. That's when it was received for us. We didn't hold on to the letter. So there was the maximum audience that you can get in the newspaper business. It was on Hall of Fame weekend, and it just did not go over well. It forced people to discuss all the holes that were in this letter. And furthermore, he was in Canton. He was performing at Michael Strahan's after party. The Buffalo News had three reporters there. We would have liked to have sat down with him and asked him these questions. Those requests were denied. And so the fact that you put it out as a letter as opposed to sitting down and answering questions, I think a lot of people looked at it and said, nice try, John Bon Jovi. Now beat it.
See, you had to go with a Michael Jackson song. You could have come up with a Bon Jovi song.
But yeah.
What's the one question you would ask if you had Bon Jovi on the line right now instead of me, and he is somewhat harder to reach than I am? What would you ask him?
What guarantees can you give for the future of the Buffalo Bills in Western New York? And I would like to hear what his explanations would be for that. And I could guarantee that he can't say that the Bills will stay in Western New York, because there are too many things that an ownership group wants. He mentioned things like new stadium in the letter. Well, what if they don't get the new stadium? Are the Bills staying in Western New York contingent upon you getting a new stadium? Because the governor and Charles Schumer, one of the most influential senators in the country, have been saying lately that they don't think the Bills need a new stadium. They're putting in a ton of money in Ralph Wilson Stadium right now. The lease goes for several more years, and they don't want to consider a new stadium. They want to retrofit Ralph Wilson Stadium if need be, much like the Chiefs did with Arrowhead Stadium, or like the Green Bay Packers do with Lambeau. Let's keep making the current one better, is the belief right now with the leading politicians in New York State. So when John Bon Jovi says that he wants a new stadium and let's work on that, well, what if you don't get one? What if the public money's not there for one? Are you going to fund this yourself? Or is this going to be your built-in excuse 4 or 5 years from now when you say, look, yeah, I told you I was going to keep the team in Western New York if I could, if we got a new stadium, but geez, guys, we don't have our new stadium, so now we have to go. There were a lot of built-in excuses in that letter that if certain conditions weren't met, then he's not a liar if he were to move the team. And so that's a lot of problems there.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point, because on one hand, you don't want to give up your leverage and say there's no way, no how we're ever going to leave. But on the other hand, using terms like intentions and we're committed to working with state and local officials, it does create an opening where if you come into this hell-bent on creating an impasse and leaving when that window opens in 2020 under the lease to buy it out for, what, $28 million, or when the lease expires after 2022, you can say, hey, I tried, and you know what, Buffalo fans, it's just a fairly short drive down the road to Toronto. The team is still here, yada, yada, yada. I think that's why folks are suspicious. Is there anything he could do or say now that would reverse this, or is it just over for Bon Jovi as far as local acceptance of him would go?
He would need to show up at a news conference right now with a shovel over his shoulder, and put a shovel in the ground, and then hold a news conference afterwards to explain that this is where the new stadium is going. We've already got the deal in place, and the Bills are going to stay, because I think that everybody thought that the only thing that would keep the Bills here if the Toronto group were to buy the team is a new stadium, because that's the fear. Okay, is Toronto going to build a stadium before Western New York can get the Bills a new stadium? It would be a cannonball run for the next few years to see who could do what, and everybody would be bracing for that. So really, I think it's to the point now where you have to have the new stadium guaranteed for here in Western New York. Terry Pegula doesn't need a new stadium. If he buys the team, the team's staying, and you don't even have to worry about it. Then you can get a new stadium in the year 2025 or something down the road. And Terry Pegula is young enough, and he has a large family, and he has discussed in the past that he's buying these things like the Buffalo Sabres. He has a music production business that he's doing this for his kids to have. at some point. He'll give them to his kids at some point. So that's relief for Bills fans, too, that these teams are going to, if he buys the team, it's staying. So the stadium issue is a big one. And I think really that's the only guarantee that that Bills fans are worried about or would quell their fears regarding the Toronto group.
There is still a football team that is playing games, played a game on Sunday night. And I don't read a whole lot into the preseason. The main objective is emerge from the games without any key players injured. But E.J. Manuel, what was your take on his first performance with Sammy Watkins on the field and in a second season where everyone is expecting him to make a big step up?
I was disappointed, not discouraged. I was just disappointed because it was Sammy Watkins' first game and it was a chance for the country to see how good he is in his Bills uniform, not playing for Clemson or what have you, but on NBC, on the big stage, and you knew the starters were only going to play a couple series, so he was going to only have a brief opportunity. So he was targeted three times, didn't have any catches. None were his fault. He was overthrown on one, and two were batted at the line of scrimmage. So I was disappointed in that. A lot of people are down on E.J. Manuel's performance. 2 of 7 for 19 yards, 11 of those yards coming on a screen pass to Mike Williams, in which he made a defender miss in the flat. So really, E.J. Manuel didn't do a lot. But he played only two series. It's the first preseason game. It's an extra preseason game. They've only been practicing for a couple of weeks in training camp. I am not going to use this as any sort of evaluation of where E.J. Manuel stands heading into his second year. They play again on Friday night at Carolina. And so they get an extra game. He's going to play more. You got to let a guy get into a rhythm. And he didn't have an opportunity to do that. And so I'm not even really going to consider the stat line when judging E.J. Manuel. There's still plenty of time to go before we need to get anxious.
How concerned should we be that when the real games come along, the Bills will dial up too many plays where Sammy Watkins is the intended receiver and E.J. Manuel will lock onto him too many times and there'll be this effort to justify the trade that allowed the Bills to move up five spots to get Sammy Watkins at a very high price?
Well, I think that's possible, Mike, and that's a great point. But I don't know that E.J. Manuel is going to be thinking about that too much. And I'll tell you why. Two reasons. He has one of the best backfields in the NFL, one of the deepest backfields in the NFL. Not only C.J. Spiller and Fred Jackson, who all fantasy people know, but Anthony Dixon has had a great training camp. They traded for Bryce Brown, so they go four deep in the backfield. And I think that the Bills are, as an offense, are probably going to rely on their running game and try to take it off of E.J. Manuel's shoulders as much as they can. Now, on passing downs, here's part two. He and Robert Woods, also entering his second year, have a great relationship. And when Robert Woods, when E.J. Manuel was healthy last year, he went to Robert Woods a ton. Slot receiver and security blanket, whatever, however you want to look at it, they have a chemistry, and he's going to get the ball a lot. So that helps keep him in a rhythm, too. So that way they could have a better opportunity of picking their spots. Now, the other guy, too, is Marquise Goodwin, the speed burner, you know, Olympic long jumper. You know, he's got the ability. And when healthy, he's a huge downfield threat. So I think that the Bills have enough weapons in their offense that they can keep defenses from double-teaming Sammy Watkins, from doing too much to take Sammy Watkins out of the game. So there should be a certain comfort level when they do want to go to Sammy Watkins. There's a good chance he should be open.
Last one for you. Cordy Glenn still missing at left tackle. Chantrell Henderson, seventh-round pick, who slid down the board largely due to some off-field issues, looked pretty good in the preseason opener. What happens when Glenn is able to come back? Does Henderson stay in the lineup? Does he take a seat, or do they find another spot on the offensive line for him?
Well, I think you'd be a prime candidate to shift over to right tackle. Cordy Glenn, according to a well-placed source with the Bills, should be back for at least one preseason game. He's fully expected to be back in time for the season opener against the Chicago Bears. So I think that the Bills are getting guys their reps, you know, wherever they can. But you might as well work Shontrell Henderson out at left tackle. And you obviously you want to protect EJ Manuel throughout camp also. But Shontrell Henderson has been, from all accounts, has been the best young lineman in camp. And he has really impressed the coaches, regardless of his checkered past. He is working hard and working well and has been impressive enough on the field to really wipe out a lot of those, or some of those concerns, I should say. There is a reason he slid down to the seventh round. But the Bills really feel like they got a steal there. And Cyrus Kwanjo, who's the 44th overall pick, he's at right tackle. He played the entire game on Sunday, which is, you know, not a good sign for a 44th overall pick to be playing the full game in the Hall of Fame, the Hall of Fame game. And he gave up two bad sacks, and he has had a rough training camp. So I think that the Bills would not have too much difficulty figuring out what to do with Shontrell Henderson once Cordy Glenn comes back.
Well, Tim, great stuff as always, both as it relates to the sale of the team and the team's fate for 2014 on the football field. We'll be talking to you again down the road. Thanks as always for your time and great work on tracking this sale story.
Thank you, Michael. Talk to you again soon.
All right, Tim Graham, Buffalo News. Yeah, he's been the go-to guy when it comes to the ins and outs and the twists and turns of the sale of the Buffalo Bills. Not, and look, when I say that, I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to upset somebody else who's been covering this story. We have a relationship with Tim because he appears on the program. But he's had a lot of good stuff, and the Buffalo News. And I does Jon Bon Jovi exclusively give that letter to the Buffalo News because he thinks he's going to get some sort of favorable treatment on the back end? If that's what he thought, it didn't happen. Not when Tim Graham comes on here from the Buffalo News and says that it did more harm than good. And at this point, pretty much nothing is going to turn around public sentiment in Buffalo regarding Jon Bon Jovi. And there's a sense in league circles he's eventually going to own a team. He may just have to move on to the next team that comes up for sale if he wants to have any shot. And he's going to have to distance himself from these Toronto people, because otherwise it's going to be an assumption he's just looking for a team that he can move to Toronto or anywhere other than where that team currently is. Here's where we are. It's time to hear from you. And before we can hear from you, we need to pick up your cell phone device and dial these numbers in this specific order. Pay attention. 888-237-5269. If you call now, you have an opportunity to ask your question, and I may try to answer it. And if you don't call, I got questions I can answer because people answered our call for Twitter questions. But call us anyway. We'll hope to get you on the program. We'll do that after the break. This is PFT Live. Oh, it's PFT Planet Time. That's the portion of the program where we answer your calls, and we pretty much always go straight to your questions submitted via Twitter. First one comes from I am N. DeRose or something. Do you think Johnny Manziel will start against the Steelers in week one? I still do. And I saw somewhere that Dick LeBeau, the Steelers defensive coordinator, thinks it's going to be Manziel. Now, maybe that's just bluster and maybe that's just talk. At some point during training camp, teams shift to focusing on that week one opponent. And part of the strategic advantage of keeping your cards close to your vest as to who the starting quarterback is, it's less time that you can spend preparing for that guy because you got to prepare for the other guy. The Browns seem to be intent on announcing someone well in advance of week one, and I still think it's going to be Manziel. When camp opened, I thought, well, maybe they really are going to sit this guy down because they don't like the off-field stuff. They don't like the fact that he has defied their wishes to keep his nose clean. That may not be the best possible choice of words. Anyway, I still think he's going to be the starter. I think all three of the rookie first-rounders are going to be starters, and I have been saying that since May 9, I hope, all three will start week one. I'm sticking with it, and if I'm wrong, well, I don't know. Will somebody come to my house and beat me up? That's always a possibility. Here's something that's more than a possibility. It's a probability. It's a definite. Mills in New York is going to join the program. What's up, man? Hello? Do we have Mills?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, what's up, man?
Hello? Hey, what's going on? With the new offensive coordinator in Detroit, how much does Reggie Bush's role diminish in the running back by committee, if any?
Hey, that's a great question, and we have to look at what Joe Lombardi, the new coordinator, has been exposed to in his past. He spent several years with the New Orleans Saints, and what do? With running backs. They rotate them, and that's the irony here. Reggie Bush got away from the Saints so he could be the workhorse, and we've seen him do great things as the number one running back with both the Dolphins and the Lions. Now he gets thrust back into this revolving door. Remember, they still have Joik Bell on the roster. They gave him a new contract in the offseason. Mekhi Lashore still hanging around, maybe not be for long, but they've got the running backs. They've got the other weapons as well. Even if Bush is the top running back, how much are they actually going to run the football? How much are they going to throw? And you've got Calvin Johnson, Golden Tate, Eric Ebron. The list goes on and on of what they can do at the offensive side of the ball and with all those weapons that they have. So, yeah, I don't know that we're going to see 1,000 rushing yards from Reggie Bush. He barely broke 1,000 last year in an underachieving season for the Lions. But, you know, less wear and tear. That's one of the reasons he's still going at a high level. Less wear and tear early in his career. It's allowed him to play at a high level deeper into his career. He may get an opportunity over the next few years to actually not play as much as he has in recent seasons. Back to the Twitter bag from @RaiderKing69. Does Oakland have enough talent to become a power to worry about in the AFC, or is another offseason going to help? I know this isn't a popular sentiment in Oakland, and I'm probably setting myself up to be horribly wrong again. I think every team right now has plausible hope to make it to the postseason and in turn plausible hope to win the Super Bowl, except for the Oakland Raiders. I know they went out and signed a lot of recognizable names in free agency, but those veteran players, those older players, they were available for a reason. I also think that the Raiders maybe overpaid some of these guys. They had a lot of cap space to spend. They had that embarrassment with Roger Saffold when they signed him to a contract and they failed him on the physical, and just a weird vibe coming out of Oakland right now. And I think it begins at the top of the organization between that and where the team is going to be. And you get the impression that Mark Davis would move on from his head coach, possibly move on from his GM, but he doesn't want to buy out the contracts, and Davis doesn't want to necessarily pay what it's going to take to get somebody else. I don't think the Raiders can make it to the postseason this year, not with their schedule. You combine the talent, you combine the ownership, you take in the schedule. They play a bunch of teams that made it to the postseason last year. They play the Broncos twice. They have three playoff teams in their division they play twice. They've got the Seahawks, the 49ers, the Rams, and the Cardinals. Long year coming for the Oakland Raiders. Long answer, but I wanted to be complete. Let's see if I have a shorter answer for Edwin H. Kraft or Krapfe. Will the Patriots add JerMichael Finley or Dustin Keller? That's at the tight end position. Rob Gronkowski, you know, there's always going to be ready for week one. I'll believe it when I see it, because this guy had a torn ACL, and he is not going to put himself at risk. I know he says he's not going to change his playing style, but until he's able to play, until he's 100%, until that torn ACL is fully healed, he's not going to expose himself to an unnecessary risk. We saw it last year with the broken arm. We're going to see it this year. I am not ready to say that he'll be out there week one, which means maybe they need some other help. I think of the two, Dustin Keller, who tore an ACL in the preseason last year on one of those low hits that needs to be removed from the game, and to a certain extent they are being removed from the game. Keller is more likely than Finley, just because with Finley, I mentioned this a week or two ago. My prediction on Finley, and I've got no inside information on this, I think he's going to take this year and see if he can get that $10 million tax-free. And if he realizes a year from now or less that it's not going to be quite as easy as we've been led to believe, then I think he's going to come back. Because I think the fact that he's already gotten offers from the Pittsburgh Steelers is going to cause his insurance company to say, you really don't have a career-ending injury. You're choosing not to play. That's not a career-ending injury. You could go back and play if you want to. You're choosing not to. We're not under obligation to give you $10 million. So I think between the two, Keller, and so much for that being a shorter answer. Let's try it again. A shorter answer. At C. Crawl, is the emphasis on defensive holding because they don't want a Seattle dynasty? Are they trying to help get Peyton Manning a ring? Well, here's the irony. The last time the NFL emphasized illegal contact and defensive holding in the passing game, that came in 2004. That came in response to complaints from Colts GM at the time, Bill Polian, who was a member of the competition committee, that the Patriots were tugging and grabbing and holding and pushing and shoving receivers, Peyton Manning's receivers, in a way that violated the rules. When that happened the last time, the flags that were thrown for the full season went from 79 to 191 for illegal contact and defensive holding, and the Patriots, who had won the Super Bowl in 2003, apparently by doing what Polian had complained about, they won the Super Bowl again. So Although Richard Sherman, Seahawks cornerback, says it's not going to change the way they play, I think it will adjust the way the Seahawks do things. They made a strategic decision last year that if not going to throw the flag as often as they should, we're just going to do it all the time. Now this year the mandate is you throw the flag when it happens. We're going to see more flags. Will it affect the Seahawks ultimately? If history is any guide, it didn't affect the Patriots the last time that this penalty, this foul, became a point of emphasis. Another question via Twitter from @ValleyMan12. Which young quarterback is going to have a breakout year? Well, how far do we go when we look at young quarterbacks? I think they're expecting it from E.J. Manuel. I'm not ready to say it's going to happen from E.J. Manuel. Nick Foles had his breakout year, but can he duplicate what he did last year coming off the bench for Mike Vick as the first-year starter from start to finish? If Bill Lazor is able to get Ryan Tannehill adjusted to the offense that he brought down from Philadelphia, I think Tannehill has the opportunity to do it. Tannehill was better last year. His offensive line was horrible. It can't be much worse this year. This is an opportunity for Tannehill to get it done, and he's got every reason to do it. As we said earlier, he finishes this third year. The Dolphins are going to have to decide whether or not to pick up that fifth-year option, which is going to be worth more than $15 million for 2016. He's got plenty of reasons to show that they didn't make a mistake when they made him the eighth overall pick in the draft a couple of years ago. And that is it for today's edition of PFT Live. Great stuff from Tim Graham. I know it was a little bit longer than usual, but it was a lot of good stuff about the Bills' sale and about the Bills' fortunes on the field for 2014. We'll be back tomorrow with another edition of PFT Live. Training camps full swing, preseason slate coming up full go on Thursday night. And this is a great time of year because the football gets spread over multiple days. We don't have to take it all in at once between 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. Eastern time on a Sunday afternoon. We can watch the games. We can study the games. We can see what happens, and we can cross our fingers that the players on our favorite teams and or the players on our fantasy lineup don't suffer a serious injury during these games that don't count. Check us out around the clock at ProFootballTalk.com. Remember to tune in 5:30 p.m. Eastern time today and every weekday. Jason Taylor in studio, Ross Tucker in studio. I'll be right here. See you then, and then see you back here again tomorrow. Have a good one.